Remington Aidney Campbell, and this is the History of Musical Theatre podcast. Where better to start with this many-character episode than with the final member of the show's actual creative team, Arthur Lawrence. He didn't get a full episode because A, he was very early career, and B, he's not Sondheim. That's not to downplay his contribution to the show, which we will get into more detail when we talk about the production itself in the next episode. But in short, he was willing to let his own work be cut or replaced with dance for the sake of the show. He was also perfectly willing to have lines he wrote stolen, appropriated into song lyrics. A lot of what made West Side Story West Side Story was Lawrence's humility with his own work. As one writer put it, no one could have foreseen how accommodating Lawrence would be in allowing his own material to be cannibalized for the good of the show. Basically just like a dream collaborator. It also wasn't just that he was a pushover either. He went on to work with Jerome Robbins and Stephen Sondheim again on Gypsy, where there were two pretty distinct visions of the show. On the one hand was Jerome Robbins, who imagined it as a kind of vaudeville piece. There were a whole host of acrobats and musicians and variety performers of all types that were initially called to rehearsals and then were bit by bit cut from the show. Because of the other vision, which was the one that Sondheim and Lawrence felt, which was as a serious character study. Predominantly a serious character study of Mama Rose. Lawrence sided with Sondheim, and they were pretty uncompromising on their vision of the show, and it created one of the most artful musicals maybe ever, despite being strongly disliked by my mum and my older sister. We've only seen the movie, and their opinion of shows is likely to be influenced by whether or not they think the characters are good. My older sister cannot stand Grease for that exact reason. We're going to get a little bit more into Gypsy in episode 8, when we start talking about the legacy of the show between Broadway and the film. Film number one. Between Broadway and film number one. So who was Arthur Lawrence? Shocking, basically no one. He grew up in a Jewish family. A family which sat in the tension that so many of the West Side Story creatives lived in between religious and cultural or ethnic Judaism. Lawrence, originally Arthur Levine, had Orthodox paternal grandparents and atheist but still ethnically Jewish maternal grandparents. His family kept kosher and attended synagogue, but as a youth, Arthur himself became an atheist. He went to Cornell University and studied theatre. Do you remember what I said about how Leonard Bernstein felt about his university experience? That it opened his eyes and yada, yada, yada? Well, Arthur was more on the Jerome Robbins side of things. Didn't find the coursework congenial and all of that. This following quote actually comes from the Cornell alum website, which is fascinating. He was not impressed by the faculty or the curriculum in the department. The reading course he designed for himself, The Socially Conscious Drama Since 1848, was, he thought, one of the pathetically few classes I took at Cornell that I enjoyed or from which I learned anything. Dream student, right there. A professor told the students that they should never begin a play with a phone ringing, to which Lawrence wrote a play starting with a phone ringing. The two of them were not friends. Lawrence called the professor a casually overt anti-Semite, and the professor said Lawrence should give up playwriting. Despite his feelings towards his university education, it prepared him for a career writing for radio. For my younger viewers, radio is like an old-timey podcast, but where you don't get to choose when to listen to certain things, it just happens. Which basically means, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Arthur Lawrence and I are pretty much exactly the same.
Yep.
Totally identical and no difference. Also a brief apology to my editor if that yep totally blew out the mic, because I found that I got better sound quality if I stopped using the pop filter. He, Lawrence, not my editor Ollie, was actually conscripted during the war, which makes him a bit of an outlier in the cohort. But he still spent those years working on theatrical projects, albeit for the war effort. He was assigned to The Armed Forces Presents... He wrote both training videos and radio scripts, which were designed to highlight what each division was doing for the war effort. It was, you know, some light propaganda. But not a bad way for him to serve a theatrical apprenticeship. After the war, he moved to writing for theatre and film. His first play opened on Broadway in 1945, Home of the Brave. I've not read the play, so I'm going to steal a synopsis from a Curtain Up review by Les Gutman. Home of the Brave takes place in 1944, in the hospital of a military base in the South Pacific, which brings together a group of men whose paths would not have crossed but for the war. A Jewish PFC, Peter Cooney Cohen, unable to walk, lies in the hospital bed as his doctor, Captain Bittiger, works to get him back on his feet. Cooney has not been injured, however. His paralysis is psychological, and the doctor, a psychiatrist, uses narcosynthesis to rehabilitate him. Continuing, this is a long synopsis. Cooney was part of an engineering outfit that volunteered to sneak onto an island crawling with Japanese soldiers to map it for an Allied invasion. Something that happened on that island prompted Cooney's condition, and since a good part of the show's dramatic tension consists of the discovery of what that is, I'm not going to give it away here. Back to Remy, I'm also not going to give it away. I'm not going to troll through a play that I just said I haven't read just to spoil it for you. What do you think I am, a sociopath? Les's words again. Captain Bittiger walks Cooney's mind through what he experienced. Much of the first and better of the two acts is a visualization of what Cooney is prompted to remember. The events, the emotions, and the relationships with his young commanding officer, Major Robinson, and his fellow soldiers. In particular, it focuses on the anti-Semitism of one soldier, TJ. Cooney's reaction to it, and the way his interaction with other members of his unit, Finch and Mingo, nurtures and fuels his feelings. Long. The TLDR, or TLDL, too long didn't listen. The play was a psychological drama about a soldier coming to terms with PTSD, although it may not have had that name at the time, the physical manifestations of it, and the way that cultures interacted, often negatively. It would receive a film adaptation in 1949, and he had a handful of other plays on Broadway before West Side Story. The Birdcage in 1950, The Time of the Cuckoo in 1952, and A Clearing in the Woods in 1957. He also wrote the script for a couple of films, including, quite notably, Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. I'm not going to give summaries of all of the plays. This is not a 7-hour show. But also, Home of the Brave was the particular piece of writing that made Jerome Robbins think he would be the perfect librettist for West Side Story. Despite the fact he'd never written a libretto for a musical before. He had been connected with members of the team, the core crew, as we could call them if, I guess, we wanted to, for a number of years, as while Fancy Free was touring, he was romantically involved with dancer and cast member Nora Kay, who was also for a time engaged to Jerome Robbins. Maybe I'll talk about her one day. She's cool. He was Robin's first choice to write the book for On the Town, but they went with Bernstein's choice of Betty Comden and Adolph Green. Time travel back to the past to learn more about them. Or don't. This is a podcast. It's not radio. You can listen to these episodes whenever. Take that, Arthur Lawrence. Ironically, Lawrence specifically didn't want to work with Bernstein on an opera. And West Side Story ended up being what could be considered a vernacular opera.
Oh, also, the classifications of different art forms are fake and depend so much on the background of the person talking about them. And the context in which they're being talked about as much as anything else. If you ask an opera person what West Side Story is, they'll give you one answer. If you ask a ballet person, they'll give you another answer. If you ask a Shakespeare nerd, they'll give you a third answer. All of these people are right.
Anyway, post West Side Story, he would go on to work extensively in musical theatre. And you should note that in my script, extensively is in all caps. Particularly working over and over again with Stephen Sondheim. It was actually Lawrence who came up with the original idea for Anyone Can Whistle, a very famous Sondheim flop. Moving on to the second member of our cohort. Probably the least well known, but it would be difficult to argue that he wasn't nearly as influential as the others. To call Oliver Smith a set designer significantly undersells his importance to the history of musical theatre. He doesn't have the same profile as Arthur Lawrence or as Harold Prince, who I'll talk about in a minute. But that doesn't make his resume any less impressive, or his impact on musical theatre history negligible. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It was Oliver Smith who first gave Jerome Robbins the correct address for Leonard Bernstein. He would go on to design sets for Fancy Free, and then suggest its adaptation into a musical, which he would then design sets for. Oliver Smith's early life has been a little resistant to research. His generic name almost certainly plays a part, as well as the fact that he's less well known than his influence would suggest. But he was born in Wisconsin and then attended Penn State, not bad. He then moved to New York and started working and living at February House, which was home to famous people who I'd never heard of, including George Davis, who was allegedly a writer and editor, and W.H. Auden, who was a supposed poet. Also, welcome to the new part of the show where I just dunk on people and question the legitimacy of their careers just because I, in my 21 years, haven't heard of them. Working at February House involved the more formal tasks, washing dishes, keeping the fire alive, and importantly, the less formal task of soothing various famous egos. Smith's start in scenic design was for ballet. Leonide Massine was a dancer and choreographer for the Ballet Russe, and Basel's Ballet Russe and Blum's Ballet Russe. I think I'll talk about that next season. In 1941, he created his ballet Saratoga, and Oliver designed the sets that started his work in Americana, a genre which he would often design for. Speaking of, Smith tended to work in the intersection between Broadway and the ballet world, a similar place to Jerome Robbins and to Agnes DeMille, who we talked about last season. The next year, he would design sets for her, specifically for her first big ballet, Rodeo. We would just say rodeo here, but apparently rodeo is the pronunciation, which was at Ballet Theatre. She described him as redheaded, 6'3", amusing and gifted, also impoverished and therefore amiable. The budget for Rodeo covered only one backdrop and a large breakfast to work out what it would be. They would be frequent collaborators, working together on Agnes DeMille's most successful ballet, Fall River Legend, based on the story of Lizzie Borden, and on a number of Broadway shows. Smith co-produced Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, along with designing sets, and specifically asked for Agnes. In all honesty, it was a bit of a miscast, or whatever the production team equivalent of that is. Her style would be best described as musical theatre ballet, with some character dance influences. Whereas Gentlemen Prefer Blondes stylistically needed jazz choreography, like Fosse or Robbins. The show was successful in spite of this, and the team would work together on Paint Your Wagon with its balletic style and Americana themes. It was more comfortably in DeMille's wheelhouse, if you'll pardon my pun. Like a wagon wheel. Years later, when DeMille would receive a letter of commendation from President Gerald Ford, it was Oliver Smith who read it aloud at the gala. His work with the ballet wasn't limited to Agnes's ballets. He worked as a set designer and then became co-director of the Ballet Theatre. Especially impressive when you remember that Ballet Theatre would go on to become ABT, or American Ballet Theatre, one of the two major New York ballet companies. His first job with Ballet Theatre was Fancy Free in 1944, and then the next year he became co-director, alongside actress and dancer Lucille Chase. Lucille had danced the original roles in ballets for Anthony Tudor and Agnes DeMille, and she'd also danced a bunch of the Russian classics. After Fancy Free, Smith would do sets again for Jerome Robbins' ballets like Facsimile and Broadway shows like Billion Dollar Baby, which he also produced. High Button Shoes, Hello Dolly, Camelot, The Sound of Music, Brigadoon, My Fair Lady, Candide, Gigi, all Smith designs. I've mixed in some pre- and post-West Side Story shows here because I kind of just wanted to give you some headlines. But my goodness, that guy did a lot of sets. On multiple occasions, he was nominated against himself for the Tony Award for Best Scenic Design. For example, in 1957, the year before West Side Story was eligible, he won the Tony Award for Best Scenic Design for My Fair Lady. He was also nominated for, A Clearing in the Woods, an Arthur Lawrence play, Candide, a Leonard Bernstein operetta, Auntie Mame, the play on which the musical Mame is based, Eugenia, and Visit to a Small Planet. Back then, scenic design for play and plays and musicals was just one category. Oliver Smith would co-direct Ballet Theatre with Lucille Chase until 1960, when Mikhail Baryshnikov took over. Smith then re-co-directed from 1989 to 1992, this time with Jane Herman. He would also be nominated for and win an insanely large number of Tonys. The third person I'm going to talk about, you've probably heard of, if you've ever seen a musical. When you hear about someone like Hal Prince, it's easy to imagine that they were born fully grown on Broadway. Now, I wanted to capitulate to popular opinion and tell you that story, but it turns out in my research, I found out that while, yes, he was born into an affluent family in Manhattan, he was in fact born a baby. He grew up in New York and attended the Franklin School, followed by the University of Pennsylvania, where he studied liberal arts. Like many we've discussed here, Harold Smith Prince, yes, that's his full name, was a smarty pants, which is the technical term. So, he studied at the University of Pennsylvania, doing all the liberal arts. He finished in 3 years, which doesn't sound impressive in Australia because 3-year degrees are pretty standard. But in America, to finish a 4-year degree in 3 years, pretty good. It was during this time that Hal first interacted with the core team. During his 3-year college education, he went to see On the Town 9 times. Meet Harold Prince, serious musical theatre fangirl. Also, I want to clarify that I do believe that fangirl is a gender-neutral term. With a degree in hand, he entered into the army, serving for 2 years in Germany in the post-war period. I imagine this had complicated feelings attached to it for him, as a member of a Jewish-German family. It was after his time in the US Army that he began to make his mark on musical theatre. And I really don't want to understate that mark. In Stephen Citron's book, Sondheim and Lloyd Webber, A New Musical, he said the following about Harold Prince's impact. There is no doubt that Harold Prince has been responsible, almost single-handedly, for shaping the post-Hammerstein musical into the daring new form he visualized. His first job in theatre was with George Abbott, who you might remember as being the director slash darling murderer discussed in an earlier episode. For a huge On the Town fangirl, this would have been a dream job. You'd get a sense for the brutal cutting of script that was sometimes necessary in a show, and indeed, Prince would go on to be known to have a very low tolerance for boredom. Working for George put Hal into his first theatre jobs, in stage management. In 1950, he was an assistant stage manager on a revue called Tickets Please, a super creative name. Then the same role on Iving Berlin's musical Call Me Madam. Next was stage managing, no assistant title here, on the 1953 musical Wonderful Town, which had a book by Betty Comden and Adolph Green. George Abbott was a producer, but he didn't actually like producing. He liked directing. So as soon as his assistants seemed ready, he gave that job to them. When they seemed ready was with 1954's The Pajama Game, co-directed by George Abbott and Jerome Robbins, and choreographed by Bob Fosse. Yes, that Bob Fosse. Peter Gennaro, who we spoke about last episode, was actually a featured dancer in this production. It was the launching point of Shirley MacLaine's career. She covered the lead, who spent a good amount of time out of the show injured, and Shirley was seen by a Paramount employee who secured a film contract for her. But more importantly for our story, it was a career starter for Prince. Part of working with Abbott involved going and checking on various tours. It was going and doing this that George started to notice another skill set that Hal might have had. In his own words, "I would often want someone to go off on the road and check up on a company that was supposed to be ragged, and I noticed that Hal always got better results than Bobby, who was the other assistant, did. And I remember telling him that I thought he was a director, because of what I saw that he had done." This eye for direction, though it wouldn't be used as a director for a number of years, served him as a producer. He wanted to defy audience expectations, saying, "When you give them a musical in a pajama factory, you can only go up from there." He produced Damn Yankees in 1955, and New Girl in Town in 1957, before Jerome Robbins brought him on to produce West Side Story, only 6 weeks out from rehearsals. But that, dear listener, is the subject of another episode. Our next episode. How did this mammoth show come to be? What was Jerome Robbins like as a director? Not nice. I'll answer that one for you. Next week, we hear all about the pre-production and production and Broadway run of West Side Story. Something's coming, and it's going to be great. I'll see you next time.